Okay, so let's start today. So I'm just reviewing the topic about upper assumption spinners. Upper assumption, we discussed that there's the combination of Lorentz transformations and translations, and the Lorentz transformations happen to be homomorphic to the group SL2C, 2 by 2 matrices. And that the fundamental representation of that group, that's what defines left-handed spinner. So this is, to be clear, we call that left-handed bias spinner, not confusion, Dirac spinner for Lorentzians. And the conjugate representation then defines the right-handed spinner. And they, I told you in the AB notation of here, this is a 1/2 0, this is a 0 1/2 spinner, and they are both related by parity that justifies the name of left and right handed. And again, for each of the two, the sigma minus and the sigma bar minus happen to be the generators of the set to C group. Good. Any questions so far? So I will try to finish this technical subjects today, and then we will see. Before getting to the fun part, I have to suffer a little bit. So let's try some analytics. For those of you who have taken the symmetries course, I think you've seen them. After writing, we really use them for the rest of the course. Uh, tres sigma sigma bar is equal to 2 times u. Sigma u alpha of the delta. This is an interesting identity that tells you that the matrix sigma, they have a constraint that you multiply by the epsilon tensor in four dimensions, if you pack the same sigma, and that is a property of all self-dual. Dual is because of multiplication by epsilon, multiplication by epsilon, and since it gives you back sigma, so that's called self-dual, whereas the sigma bars are anti-self-dual. Sense that they have the same relation but with a minus sign. So identity said if you haven't worked this out, it would be fun to try it just to get your hand free with the calculations. There is a book that sometimes I hesitate to recommend because it makes a lot of calculations, but if you are interested for all these things, I will mention it just in case. There's a reference. It's an old book. It's called Supersymmetries. And the authors are Müller-Christian and the Wiesenthal. This is very old, and even the questions are written with a handwriting. But they go on all the details of the Galilei calculations. So you want to have all the things of minus signs and so on. That's a good reference to try, just if you want you're stuck in some calculations, that may help. As you saw with this very detailed things, that there are some mistakes in the calculation, so don't trust everything you see. But I think it's really quite useful if you want to see how the calculations are done in this two-dimensional sphere of components. Okay. So then we'll continue with some product of spinners. And the first is that you have the product of two spinners side to side, defined to be psi alpha, in this order, which is important. And this, of course, is just you lower the index, this index and raise that index by using epsilon. That would be minus psi alpha. Psi alpha. Similarly, for the conjugate spinners, the product is the same, but following the order in the opposite direction. So now you contract from bottom to up. And again, this is minus alpha. So that's just convention. So there's not that much to understand here, except that you will see why it's convenient to find it in this way. In particular, particular, we have the product of two spinors, or the spinor by itself, so psi squared. Psi. That would be, and according to this, that would be psi alpha. Which is, you can write this as epsilon alpha d steps. Alpha theta, psi theta, psi alpha. And if we use the definition of epsilon, which is the total anti-symmetric tensor, that happens to be, that will give you psi 2, psi 1, minus psi 1, psi 2. Okay. So that means that the square of spinor gives you this difference of those two terms. This is one motivation to choose now this number, this spinor numbers, to be anti-commuting. If they were commuting, psi 2, psi 1 equals to psi 1, psi 2, the square of the spinor would be 0. So that's not very exciting. So we will choose the other way around. We will choose the psi 2 and the psi as components as to be Grassmann numbers, the numbers which are anti-commuting. So it's a convention, so that means that psi 1, psi 2 equals to minus psi 2, psi 1. Okay. Or in general, we can write psi alpha, psi beta, b, one half, epsilon alpha beta, times psi psi. Leads to some further identities. Here's identity set of psi equals to psi. Sorry, I forgot. There's something that isn't the commuting property of the spinors implies then that psi psi will then be equal to, if you then change this order, that will be psi alpha chi alpha with minus sign, so that will be equal to psi chi. Okay. Did you get that? Very important. So this is in general, up to here we didn't know they were anti-commuting. If they're anti-commuting, I change the order, then it will be psi chi, which is the order, take a minus sign, and then we have that. Okay. And so on. Also, we have, psi, and then we can define the dagger, say that psi dagger is equal to theta bar psi bar, and psi sigma mu kappa dagger equals to psi sigma mu psi bar. this just, it's just the properties of a of the spinners and the complement and the sigma matrices. But you have to know what the dagger means for a spinner. And for dagger, we're using this psi alpha dagger. It's just psi bar alpha dot. And also, for future use, it's good to know that psi bar alpha dot can be obtained from the corresponding spinner. By complex conjugating and multiplying by a matrix sigma zero. So this is just a way of controlling the indices notation. Remember that sigma zero is just identity. So this is just identity times the corresponding spinner complex conjugated. So that brings it from the complex conjugation to the dotted notation. So just that changes from theta to alpha dot. Okay, so you use this definition, and then that will be true. Okay, so to close this, let me just write a connection to Dirac spinners. Okay, so far I introduced for you the two component spinners, and they have to be related to the more standard spinners that we deal with in quantum theory, which are the Dirac spinners. And for that, you can define the gamma mu matrices to be 0 sigma mu, sigma mu bar 0. I know the properties of the sigma mu. This implies that this gamma matrix satisfies the following parameters. So that means that this gamma matrix is defined in this way are a representation of the Dirac algebra. Find the gamma mu's, and then the gamma phi is defined to be gamma 0, 1, 2, 3. And if you just use this definition for the gamma, this time to give you minus the identity in two dimensions, 0. Dimensions. And of course this gamma phi has eigenvalues plus or minus 1, and that is what is defined as chirality. Gamma mu I offer gamma mu to be this object, which I call sigma mu, which is the diagonal of two dimensions defined by the sigmas and sigma bars, which are the generators of SL2C. And then, because of that property, this sigma mu's are the generators of a Lorentz group. In the sense that since sigma and sigma bar satisfy the algebra, then the capital sigma also satisfies the algebra. From here we define the Dirac spinner. Dirac spinner psi d, we define it to be the pair psi alpha chi bar alpha dot. So we combine a left-handed and a right-handed Bayer spinner, and that will give you Dirac spinner. So we can, well, notice that if, since gamma phi, we can apply gamma phi to this Dirac spinner, and that will give us minus psi alpha chi bar alpha dot. So then we can have the projector project P L B 1/2 1 minus 1/5 and P right B 1/2 alpha gamma 5. Such that then P left acting on the Dirac spinner, this will give this will cancel this part and will give that, so that that will give you just the Bayer spinner psi alpha 0 and P right acting on the Dirac spinner. That will give you only the right hand component of the Dirac spinner. So again, this is this will be left handed. That will be right handed spinners. Finally, we define the conjugate psi Dirac bar to be just the world object. Like that. This can be seen to be zero. Then we just make this into a column object. I call it this conjugate C. That is alpha. This happens to be just a matrix C times psi bar B, where C is a matrix of depth of densities. And this is the complex, the charge conjugation. that's what essentially what changes you particles to antiparticles. That's what the conjugate is, essentially. So we will see that, for instance, if a psi Dirac satisfies the Dirac equation with a positive sign for the electric charge, the psi D conjugate will satisfy the same equation with the opposite sign for the electric charge. So that will define the conjugate particle. And then the last thing is the Majorana spinors. Is you take a Dirac spinner and set chi alpha equals psi alpha equals chi alpha. That means that the Majorana spinner psi n you can write that as a psi alpha psi bar alpha. So now these two objects are the same. One is the complex conjugate of the other. That's just usually assigned a Majorana spinner with a reality property, so it's like a real object. And in fact, psi n, you use the definition of the complex of the conjugate spinner that happens to be equals to its conjugate. So that's why it's a real object. So at any, in the same way that we can decompose a Dirac spinner in terms of a right-handed and left-handed violet spinners, we can also decompose any Dirac spinners in terms of a Majorana components. So we can always write a Dirac spinner to be psi Majorana 1 plus I psi. In that regard, then the conjugate Dirac spinner will be minus pi. And so this is a property of Majorana spinner. So we have seen violet, Majorana, and Dirac spinners. We can ask the question if there is a spinner which is both Majorana and violet in four dimensions. But this will not happen. So notice. No. Majorana violet. In 4D. I emphasize that this is in 4D. That means that you want to have a spinner that is both Majorana and violet. If it is violet, that means that one of the components is zero here. But if it is Majorana, both components are equal. So that means that they would both be zero. So there's no spin. Okay. That's the thing. That it cannot be both at the same time Majorana and violet. Is that clear? Yeah.
What is the meaning of the Majorana decomposition?
Sorry, what is the
zero? Physical meaning of the decomposition of the Majorana.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's good to treat. In general, we can have some reality components of spinners. That's informal. But for instance, in practice, people have talked about the neutrino being a chargeless particle can be real. It can be a Majorana. That's kind of, I mean, you can have that kind of implication. So it's good to have in mind what kind of problem you have. Remember that the charged objects are usually complex, but neutral objects can be real. So then people say, well, then the neutrino could be a Majorana particle. Okay, so. Whereas, as it's good to you pointed out, that whereas the violet spinners are very physical because we know that the world is separated between left and right. So we know that there is difference between left and right. And you will see that the standard models, elements in the standard model are definitely left-handed, or sorry, right-handed. Okay, so this is the end of this review. I think this is difficult. This was difficult for me because for some of you, this is the end time that you have said these kind of things. For others, this is the first time. And for the ones that is the first time, it's very difficult. For the ones that is the fourth time, it's very boring. So I try to make it fast, at least to diminish the suffering. And but please come to me. There's those of you thought that it's very fast, that you miss some things, then please come to me and ask me questions. Okay. So, good. So now we'll move to the next chapter. Supersymmetry that I will be sure I will write Susie as usual. So supersymmetry. So before starting talking about the formal aspects of our supersymmetry, I have to tell you about the history. So, this started in a time that there was a lot of confusion and people were doing kind of a lot of crazy things. And that means that it's in the 60s. So in the 60s there were many things going on. And in particular for our field, people were doing classification of particles regarding the different quantum numbers and put them into multiples. For instance, there was this idea of Heisenberg and this isospin idea. I'm sure you have heard about that you can define a symmetrical isospin, which was an SU2, for which a neutron and a proton were different states of that. Like different spin states with respect to that symmetry with isospin. So essentially that would explain why the neutron and the proton would be so close in mass.
And that was Kama.
What's Kama?
Kama.
Kama, oh thank you.
Kama.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, good, thank you. And then people started using the symmetry arguments and came up with a bigger symmetry. Instead of SU2, consider SU3. And SU3, you can classify particles in bigger multiples. Instead of just having two particles in one multiple, now you can have bigger multiples of octets or decuplets and so on. That was SU3, and that was the famous eightfold way of Kelvin and Niemann. And that was a nice way, given so many particles. So at this time, there were hundreds of particles being discovered, all these resonances and so on, and hadrons in general. And so they wanted to put them in some order, to classify them in some way. And so SU3 was very successful, but in SU3, every single multiple, octets, decuplets, and so on, they happened to be of the same spin. So it was an octuplet of mesons and so on, but some other variants, but they were all the difference. Within one multiple, they all have the same spin. So then people say, well, what about having symmetries that mix spins? So you have in one bigger multiple that puts two of those multiples together. One octet with spin 1, or spin 0, or so, and one octet with spin 1/2, or so. And So they were postulating bigger symmetries, like SU6, so this kind of thing. But, and actually, they had some mixture of, they were missing spin and an SU3 symmetry. So that was the idea at that time, that they can evolve symmetries that mixes the internal symmetries, which were like isospin or the SU3, with the space-time symmetry, the one that give you spin. So we have multiplets for which probably because this difference spin would be in the multiple. So that was what people were doing in the 60s. So they were studying the strong interaction because the hadrons that were given the big multiplicity of particles. And so as I said, the particles were successfully classified, organized in multiplets. SU3, which is what we now recognize as SU3 flavor. And the question was, can there be bigger multiples including different spins? And people were playing with that, especially with non-relativistic models, and they wanted to see if this would be extended to relativistic models. However, in 1967, something very exciting happened. Do you know what happened in 1967? The Beatles came with the Sgt. Pepper's. Che Guevara was killed. What else happened? Magritte died. There was this war of the 6 days. Actually, Weinberg, closer to us, Weinberg came up with a famous paper that defines the standard model. That was 1967. So there were a lot of things happening. And probably because of that, people didn't realize that there was this occurring. Supposon Emanuel. Goldman and Mandula, they have what is called as a noble theorem for this question. So they said that this was not possible. That's it. So, the thing is that they trying to look for the most general symmetry of scattering amplitudes that included the space-time symmetries and internal symmetries. And they concluded that the most general symmetry of the asymmetries that is the scattering metric that it gives you the amplitudes and the interactions of particles was just simply a direct product, boring kind of direct product of Poincaré symmetry times internal symmetry. Okay. So that means here you will have all the commutation relations between the generators mu and mu nu that I mentioned before. And here you have the generator called, say, PA. Well, these generators were scalars with respect to the space-time symmetry. So essentially, they will have an algebra by themselves, maybe a big algebra or whatever, but they will just commute with all the space-time generators. And that means that there will not be any way to mix one single multiplet things of a different spins, because they will just commute with internal symmetries. So you have as big a symmetry you want here, but in every multiple, everything will have the same spin. So that is the content of the Kalman-Mandula theorem. And you could have imagined that a Freud could have tried to use that as a way to guide themselves to how to change the assumptions of the theorem and generalize it. However, people essentially this played no role at all, this theorem, for a while. So people actually probably they were ignorant about it, or they didn't care. But at least it didn't have any influence in the discoverers of Steven. This happened in 1971. That was an interesting year also. What happened in 1971? I think Picasso died on here.
Did Nixon invade Cambodia?
Yeah. We have a lot of activity regarding the Vietnam War. And I think there was a war in India and Pakistan. And so a lot of things were going on there. And again, for us, the most important part that happened that year is the work of in the Soviet Union at that time, Wolf and Lippmann. They were just doing something just purely algebraic. What they did is just to extend it. Poincaré algebra. Include Skinner generation. To alpha, or alpha is the index we have been using for Skinner. So that means that the Poincaré algebra that had only vector-like and tensor-like objects. They just play with it by Pierre Ramon to say that they were working in string theory. In string theory, at that time, they were worried about including spinners in string theory, which happened to be a two-dimensional object because of the two-dimensional field theory, which is the worship of the string two-dimensional object. So they introduced spinners in two dimensions to include them into the formulation of the string theory. And that was supersymmetric for the So, from the string theory. So it was nice to see that even from its origins, string theory has played an important role with supersymmetry and having a close relationship with both. In 1973, what happened in 1973? It was the beginning of the Watergate scandal, I think. What has happened? Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. A lot of things happened. And at that time, the Volkov and Angelos. Again, in the Soviet Union, apparently without knowing the work of Dolphin and Lippmann, they were speculating that they were trying to understand why the neutrino was a massless particle, or looked to be a massless particle at that time. And there was a nice result in the past due to Goldstone that you would see in the standard model course, which is that there are natural to massless bosons. As the origin of the because of some symmetries that are the Boltzmann bosons, So they were thinking that probably the fact that the neutrinos were massless was because of a symmetry, of a broken symmetry. And so they tried to have the neutrinos as Boltzmann particles. That means that that explained that the mass was zero. And that was a very nice idea because for usually in a standard symmetry, these Boltzmann particles being massless, these bosons are bosons, they're called Boltzmann bosons. And they came out, so there has to be a symmetry that implies that there have to be Boltzmann fermions, because the neutrinos are fermions. And that also was the sense that the origin of they discovered not only supersymmetry, but also how to break supersymmetry, supersymmetry breaking. And again, this is completely unrelated to the previous one, so it was it's curious to see everything so close in time, which were being unrelated. However, what we consider the real beginning of supersymmetry is in 1974. 1974 is the work of West and Titus West and Smino. West and Sumino, they actually, I think they knew now the work of Ramon et al. In two dimensions. And they said, well, this symmetry is very beautiful, so let's see if there is something in four dimensions where we can have actually field theories with supersymmetry. So they started the supersymmetric theory. And it was actually this work of Wes and Sumino, a series of papers, very impressive, that actually this boosted the interest of most of the finite energy community into supersymmetry. First just by just formal things, and then people realized that they have some applications to phenomenology. That was realized several years later, in 77 and then in the 80s mostly. But I think for most people this is the breakthrough, in the sense that this is the paper that, or the set of papers that imply that how supersymmetry could be used in effectively in field theories. And then they explore all the beautiful properties of supersymmetry that we will observe and we start discussing next. I think I have only 3 minutes. I don't have that much to say to start the next thing, the technical thing. So I better stop here.